all of us have healing work to do on race and culture topics. We have those questions that seem to be unaskable in today's climate. Now, we have a forum where we can ask experts, listen, and share. Welcome to A Safe Place to Talk About Race with your host, Sharon E. Davis. Get ready to engage and add your voice to racial healing in the next hour. Let's start right now. Here's Sharon E. Davis.
Welcome to our show once again, A Safe Place to Talk About Race. I'm again delighted that you have taken time out of your day to join us. You know, we're going to have a conversation today with members of our human family, all kinds of members of our human family. And, you know, we were born into these stories, and it's not our fault that we don't know the other parts of the story. So today is another one of those days that we're going to address a topic, and the title is Police Officers and Race Bias. What's the whole story? Well, today we have Dr. Philip Atiba Goff with us, and he is a researcher and assistant professor of social psychology at the University of California at Los Angeles, and he's also executive director of research for the Consortium for Police Leadership in Equity. Hi, Dr. Goff. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Sharon.
Oh, you're more than welcome. Thanks for taking time. Well, you know, we've learned our way into racism. I call it the ditch, basically, and we're digging our way out. And the saints of the 60s did their job. They really provided a lot of the laws for us that are now in place. And it seems now that equity is what our role is for the future. And you've done so much in this arena. And we're just looking forward to hearing some of the things that you're doing and have done and will do as it relates to a topic that's in the news quite a bit related to police and society. Well, you know, you had said something to me the other day, and it just rang bells. You said something like, racism is not only for the racists.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's absolutely right. So growing up, I grew up in just outside of Philadelphia. I was born in West Philadelphia and grew up in the suburbs. And, you know, I was taught, like many of us, that, you know, racism is something that we're still healing from, but it mostly exists over there. It mostly exists in a time far away, in a land far away. You know, I thought that racist individuals were people that tended to wear overalls, had red necks, chew on straw. They were from the South, and they said y'all a lot, even more than my family did. And so it was a rude awakening to realize that, you know, in my, you know, northern, suburban, you know, highly educated life, that you could have folks who could be just as ignorant about and just as uninformed about the way that race functions as anybody anywhere else. And that really what was most hurtful for me is the only way I had to talk about it was I had to talk about it in terms of the people who had the negative attitudes, the people who had the wrong-headed beliefs, as opposed to the ways in which it affected me. And it's really limited the ways in which we can talk about it, because if racism is just about the racist people, then we never get around to healing the folks who are targeted for discrimination. And we never get around to talking about the situations where there's nobody who holds bigoted beliefs, yet people are still harmed. And that's what I've really devoted most of my research and, you know, my activist life to.
Well, you've certainly expanded the landscape about what healing is about. So it really includes everybody has a role in this thing about the healing of racism. Well, that's just extraordinary. Well, what were some of the differences between racism then and now, maybe what your parents were born into?
Yeah, so I have two parents, like most of us. My mom's from Greensboro, North Carolina, the site of the famous Walmart sit-ins. My dad's from North Little Rock, Arkansas, so he was stopped on his way to school as they were trying to integrate Central High while he was on his way to junior high school. That's a very different style of racial tension and racial conflict than what we understand today. And I think it's both natural and in some ways it's healthy that it's easy, so easy to lose sight of that. But that's not the end of the story. So what I like to talk about when I teach in class on this or when I talk to my friends, it was hard work getting the signs taken off of the water fountains. It was really difficult, as you said, to get the laws on the books to say that as a country, we no longer hold this to be the set of values that we want to endorse. But it's not as if racial discrimination was born on the Mayflower, and it ended with the Civil Rights Movement. It's not as if people have been treating each other equally forever and ever that America was born, and all of a sudden we were messing it up for a little while, and now we got it back on track. The problem of people treating people differently is really, really old, and it's in part because it's such a deep part of the way that we're human. We're hardwired and softwired to do that to each other, to distinguish black from white, male from female, old from young. And so learning about ourselves in this human process is really part of the mantle that this generation has, to distinguish between when you had to bring out the National Guard just to get a few black school children into the right schools, to now when it appears as if everything is possible, and yet the possible is not turning into what's actually happening in people's lives.
Well, that's a very, very profound statement. I think people feel that. Racial healing is about feeling. So it seems that the opportunities would appear to be there, but it just isn't quite making the jump across this gap for true equity and equality at this time. Well, you know, I'd like for us to explore a little bit before we go deeper into your comments about your work with the Consortium for Police Leadership and Equity. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. It's one of the many things in my life that's a very happy accident. I'm a social psychologist and a social cognitive psychologist as well. What that basically means is I study what's happens when people get into different situations. So I have no idea what your mama did to you, and I can't help with that. But I do have a sense of what happens when groups of people get in particular circumstances. It was a number of years ago, I guess four and a half years ago now, that I was, it's a bit longer than that. I got 6 years now. I was sitting in a conference room, and there was a lovely woman in a dress full of, in a room full of law enforcement, some in uniform, some just very clearly law enforcement with badges on suits. And we started talking, and we had an instant sibling kind of relationship. That woman is Tracy Cassie. She's a captain in the Denver Police Department. And at the time, she was a commander of one of the districts. And she just basically challenged me. She said, "I bet you don't have the guts as a researcher to get into the real world and get your hands dirty with this police work and find out what's really going on." And I said, "Well, I bet you don't have the guts to let me come in and do what I'd really want to do." And she said, "June." I said, "May." She said, "Let's go." And that's what happened. So we went in, we did a couple of projects in Denver, and then from there, she had the idea, well, if we buy people chicken, maybe they'll let us come out and do this in other places. So we hosted a chicken lunch for various chiefs at the Major Cities Chiefs Association. That's the association for the 70 largest law enforcement agencies in the U.S. and Canada. And we said, who would be interested in allowing researchers to come in and do some really innovative, in some senses scary stuff to find out what is the state of racial bias within law enforcement? And to our surprise, we were overwhelmed by the response. And that's how the CPLE was born, to create an organization to match researchers, particularly mind scientists, so psychologists, neuropsychologists, folks like me, with police departments that had questions about how do we do diversity right? Forget about just the numbers. We're past the numbers now. Once we've got the people in the building, how do we help everybody just get along and move beyond getting along to actual equity and justice? And so that's what the CPLE is designed to do. And in doing that, our goal is to provide academic researchers, those of us who are, you know, professional nerds, to communities to give a broader lens on the kinds of problems that communities face. So it's not just for law enforcement, though that's our point of entry. The point is to allow research to be a tool that communities can use to create a language, to create common ground, to solve the issues that are troubling those communities.
Well, you know, that's fascinating, more than fascinating, Dr. Goff, because it seems it would take a lot of courage in that environment, in policing, to open up their books, to allow someone to come in and actually see the data. Now, I understand that they didn't pick and choose the data. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah. The kind of courage it takes. Let me walk you through what it looks like when a police department contacts us. So first, it's not the case that when the NAACP or ACLU or any place says, "Hey, we have a concern about that police department," they can't call us and have us go in. We don't go in unless a police chief or a sheriff. The law enforcement executives have to invite us in.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And And why would they invite you in? What is it?
Right. So the issue is, believe it or not, there are chiefs that are tired of getting the same thing over and over again. So there are consulting agencies that go out, and what they do is they study police departments. But they've been studying racial profiling and other such stuff for decades, and a number of police chiefs feel as if those consulting agencies don't have the expertise that the academics do. And they really do care about getting it right. And it makes sense. I know that in a lot of our communities, you know, I grew up thinking that, you know, police just, they wanted the badge and the gun so they could feel superior. That was the stereotype that I grew up with. But the reality is, who on earth would choose as their profession to get paid frequently not as much money as they could be making elsewhere to stand in front of a bullet that's meant for you? Who would do that except someone who desires to be a hero for a living? Now, I gotta say, as much as that's difficult to make manifest, as much as you might get disillusioned with that, that's really at the core of what it means to join a police department. And you get a police chief or sheriff, a lot of those folks still want to be heroes. They see it in a more complex network than just, I'm the guy, you know, wearing the bulletproof vest. But they want to be heroes, which means they've got a highly developed sense of right and wrong, and many of them see that despite their best efforts, they're still producing inequalities with regards to race and gender and sexual orientation the way they're doing things. So they call us up because they want to make a difference, and race is hard, so they haven't figured out how yet. And our job is to try and help them do that.
Well, you know, Dr. Goff, I was amazed at the number of police departments that are involved. And, you know, anybody can go out and on our website at www.safeplaceonrace.com and get a hold of more information about this consortium. But I think the key thing here is that it looks like the Salt Lake City Police Department is part of the Chief's Advisory Board in San Jose and the Houston. I was very impressed with this list.
Well, it's an impressive group of chiefs, I do have to say. And you're being impressed, that should go back to those chiefs who chose to stand up and do something about it. So, you know, one of the things that we study is racial profiling. That's sort of obvious. It's in the news a lot with the stop and frisk issue, especially with NYPD. But another major issue is cross-deputization. That's this Arizona law that people were up in arms about for a long time, this concern that we were going to tell police officers, you need to go. And if you suspect, you've got reasonable suspicion that someone is in the country illegally, you got to go ahead and ask them for papers. And if they don't have the papers, you got to lock them up. There are a lot chiefs that feel that that's not only wrong, they'll come right out and say it's racist.
You know, we're going to have to come right back because actually we've come to our first break. We'll be right back.
Okay.
Ask the experts. Call toll-free right now, 1-866-472-5787.
Hello?
And ask our all-star team to answer your question. That's 1-866-472-5787.
Thank you for calling.
VoiceAmerica.com.
Are you struggling to find hope in the middle of adversity? How confident are you in dealing with your life challenges? Do you realize you have the ability to overcome your obstacles? You'll want to tune in to Louise Cohen's Changing Obstacles into New Possibilities. Louise will speak to inspiring guests who have helped others or managed to overcome the roadblocks that stood in the way of their life's success. Louise Cohen's Changing Obstacles into New Possibilities broadcasts live every Tuesday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, noon Pacific Time on the Voice America Variety Channel. The latest business information is made simple with the Voice America Business Network. The professionals in the business world bring you live talk radio shows featuring an array of business topics, strategies for building wealth, sales and marketing, stock trading, investing, and business technology. Voice America Business hosts are professionals in their fields and bring to the airwaves weekly business discussions that offer up-to-date information, advice, and education. The Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business talk.
Very rarely does our news media spotlight some of the good things that are happening in our world. For more of these good stories and the people that are creating them, tune in to Bread for the Journey with Mariana Cacciatore. Whether these good acts stem from personal tragedy or just a desire to help out and make this a better world in which to live, you'll find inspiration in every week's program. Connect with those that are doing something great for a change. Listen for Bread for the Journey, Saturdays at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Variety Channel.
Stimulating talk.
It gets those synapses in the brain firing really fast.
All the time. The number one internet talk station where your opinion counts. VoiceAmerica.com.
You are tuned in to A Safe Place to Talk About Race with your host, Sharon E. Davis. We know you have something to say, so participate in today's discussion by calling 1-866-472-5788. That's 1-866-472-5788. Or send us an email to Sharon at safeplaceonrace.com. Now, back to the program.
Oh, welcome back. We're here with Dr. Philip Atiba Goff, and he is the Assistant Professor of Social Psychology at UCLA and also the Executive Director of Research for the Consortium for Police Leadership in Equity. And we just had a great segment going, and we want to continue forward. And in particular, in part, Dr. Goff, you talked about the police want to be heroes. That was very intriguing, and want to do good. Can you take it up from there?
Absolutely. When we were took our break, I was talking about Chief Chris Burbank, who's the chief in Salt Lake City Police Department. Chief Burbank is a fascinating guy. He's got a history as a professional squash player, among other things. But when this cross-deputization thing came up, this Papers, Please law in that has gotten a lot of attention from Arizona, it first came up in Utah. And he saw it and he said, I don't think that I can instruct the men and women who work with me to enforce a law like this without engaging in racial profiling. And if we do that, what we're going to be doing is we're going to send people running and hiding for the hills. They're going to be afraid of police. They're going to believe that police are not fair and not just. And not only is that wrong in and of itself, but the men and women that work with me, they're going to hate their jobs because they signed up to do good, to do the right thing for a living. And he thought that was just going to be too demoralizing. So he enlisted our help to show that he was right. And, you know, we went out and said, well, we're not sure if you're right, but we'll ask your officers and we'll ask your civilians. And it turns out he was. It wasn't just that Latinos were going to be afraid of law enforcement and think they weren't fair. White folks were too. And all of his officers, regardless of whether or not they supported the law, were concerned that they wouldn't like their jobs as much because they weren't going to be perceived as being fair and honest. Who the heck wants to sign up for that? And that's the kind of courage that our police chiefs have, that I have to say it makes me proud to be working with them.
Well, when you talk about this particular law, can you give a summary of what it was?
Sure. The law has different manifestations in different states, but essentially any cross-deputization law requires that local or state law enforcement do the job that used to be reserved for federal immigration officers. So what that means is essentially they're going around, and in some states they have to ask for papers. In some states they have to, you know, be proactive and go looking for it. And in other places, if they've already made an arrest or a stop, that's the point where they have to ask. But the point is they're patrolling in part to catch people who are here in the country without proper documentation. And what it does is it sends a shock of fear through communities, even if you're not here illegally. What would it feel like if, just because of the way you looked, someone said, I'm not sure that you belong, you need documentation to prove it?
Yeah, that kind of thing is very frightening to a wide variety of people. It gives you chills, actually.
Yeah.
Well, let's take one of the emails that came in and see where this leads us. This is from an email from Bob in Detroit. It says, great show. It says, during the L.A. riots, many African Americans expressed their views that the L.A. police profiled all African Americans. My question, is this pervasive in many large city police forces, and how can it be corrected?
So the question of racial profiling, which is at the heart of Bob's email, it's a difficult one for anybody who cares about getting it right to do right. So let me respond to it just a couple of things. I know that there is some contention around, do we call it the L.A. riots or the L.A. insurrection? Because a riot isn't organized. An insurrection is about justice. Mm-hmm. And similarly, on the other side, do we think that all law enforcement engage in racial profiling? I got to say, I've done research on exactly that topic. It is a small number of folks who are responsible for a large number of complaints. Right. So it's not the case that once you join, you know, that so-called wall of blue, that you end up sort of getting your racism card in the mail. It doesn't work that way. But it is the case that just like in every other profession, police have to hire from the human race. And they can't screen out folks because of biases. It's, in fact, not legal in lots of different places to do that, much as many police chiefs would like to. So you're going to have folks who are committed to doing social justice, and you're going to have some racists. You're going to have some bigots on the force.
Dr. Goff, you've hit on one of these emails that have come in that really, hold on a second, let me read it to you, and then maybe you can respond to it. I think you've answered it, but I don't know if our listener will really like or appreciate that answer. It says, when is the Blue Brothers culture going to change? I've seen it in Detroit and New Orleans. We thought that when African Americans were more in the majority, the hyper-violence would stop, but it hasn't. We still see instances among where black men are being targeted. That's just one part of the question.
Mm-hmm.
So you mentioned, yeah.
Yeah, and I do have to say, we went in looking to see if we would see racial differences on the part of the officers. So do black and Latino officers treat black and Latino communities differently? They do, but lots of times not in the ways that the communities would hope for.
Mm-hmm.
So communities have, for a long time, fought to make sure that the force that was protecting them, that was servicing them, and making sure that crime was kept away from the neighborhoods, that force represented them. Unfortunately, if policing culture is a culture that leads to conflict with the community, it's not going to matter that much. That's good news in some ways, because it means it's not about evil white cops. It's absolutely not. But it's hard news because it means the problems of race are deeper than just, well, you know, you're from this group and you don't have to worry about it. So I understand what the emailer is frustrated with. I got to tell you, you've got black and white law enforcement that are at least that frustrated and probably more because they live with it every day and it's a bad reflection on them. But I want to get this point out too. It's not just about good or bad officers. It's not about the racist or the bigot. Right? It's about situations that conspire to make it harder for each of us to treat each other the way that we would like.
Okay, explain that? Yes.
Yeah, let me give you an example. So I went through a very preliminary training on the use of force, okay, and officer safety training as part of my research. I got to understand the folks that I'm studying. And as part of the officer safety training, they tell you very clearly, you must maintain control over a situation in order for everybody to go home safe. And in layman's terms, let me put it to you like this. If I'm stopping you, Sharon, and you think you can take me, one of us is going home hurt. Because there's going to be a fight.
Yeah.
Now, if I've got my moral authority with me, if I'm saying, I am the law, I'm wearing the badge, I got this itchy blue polyester uniform on, you got to do what I say, then that's a lot of the reason and the way in which I keep control. That's why you get the alpha officer when you first get stopped. Right, because they want to make sure that you know who is in charge. And your moral authority is what you're supposed to use. But here's the trick. If you lose your moral authority, you've only got one other form of authority left, which is your physical authority. Okay, now I put it to you, any officer, black, white, Latino, approaches a car full of black youth, Latino youth, and out of experience, they know that car full of folks is at some point going to call the officer a racist. What kind of moral authority does the officer have in that situation? Very, very little, if any at all. And so it's not about the officer doesn't like that group of folks. The officer feels like that group of folks doesn't like them, and they've got no choice if something escalates but to use physical force. Now, the officer may or may not be right. The kids in the car that I was talking about may or may not be justified in calling the officer racist. But that doesn't have to be about a bigoted officer or a group of thugs. It's a normal human response to a difficult situation that has been developed over time. And that's what we got to get if we want to humanize everybody in that situation. It's a normal human response. And we got to do better than normal and human. We got to be extraordinary and human if we want to get this thing any better.
Well, being extraordinary and human really puts you in a rare ballpark, it would appear, to be extraordinary and human under situations and circumstances that, quite frankly, might just be life and death. So there's another question that came in from May in Los Angeles that relates to this. She says, do they still do the old psych tests for police? I think you mentioned earlier about that there isn't any screening for bias, but let me finish your question. Let's see where it goes. Do they still do old psych tests for police? Do they include race? Why is there more killing of all people these days by police, not just the black ones?
Well, they do include the old psych tests, and by old, it is pretty old. It's the MMPI. It doesn't matter what the acronym is for. It's a psych evaluation for how are you going to do under stress, how are you going to respond to authority and leadership. They do that in pre-employment screenings, so you have to score above a certain amount to be eligible. I got to say, it has nothing to do with race. It also has nothing to do with bias or the kind of vulnerabilities to the moral threats, like I was just talking about, that we now know relate to unhappy disparities on the streets. So the psych tests, I think everyone will agree, are inadequate, but it's the best that we've developed that's legal for the time being. Now, in terms of the more deaths, I can't say that seems to be the case from the secondary data that I look at. It doesn't appear to be that police are killing more folks. It's just that it's in the news more often. And it's in the news more often in part because I think we've come to realize we've got an issue where our law enforcement is doing a wonderful job at reducing crime. But it's time for us to join in partnership with law enforcement to do a better job of building communities. And that's what the chiefs that I work with are trying to do. And you gotta admire folks who may be endangering their careers by trying to do the right thing. It's not quite whistleblowing, but it is really leadership. And that's what they sign up for. They sign up to be extraordinary human beings. And those are the folks that I want policing, you know, my neighborhoods where my family's at.
Well, you know, because we are in racial healing and we believe in the oneness of humankind and that we're all members of the same human family, and if I was a police officer, which I'm not, then I would probably act the way the police officers act because we're members of the same species and vice versa. If they were doing a radio show and born into my story, that's the way that they would react too. And is this then a lot about the condition of the, if you want to call it the downfall of our society and what we've gotten into this ditch with that has led us to the point where moral authority relates to more physical authority in terms of just everyday occurrences related to crime? Is that where we are?
Yeah, I mean, and again, I don't want to call it the downfall, because I think that there's a story of hope here, but it is the case that historically, we've dug ourselves into a ditch. Now, I may approach an officer, and that officer may not feel that I am threatening her moral authority, in which case, now we're back to where we were. But it makes sense that race would be something that makes folks feel like they don't have as much moral authority because of the history of race and policing. That officer didn't do anything wrong. That civilian, that resident didn't do anything wrong. And yet, that's the situation we find ourselves in. And when we come back from the break, it might be the right time to also be talking about the ways in which the human mind can play tricks on us. It normally serves us very, very well. It allows us to navigate our days great. But it also does us disservice when it comes to, you know, creating group differences, even beneath conscious awareness.
Oh, that's excellent. We'll be right back from break.
Talk, talk, talk. That's all we do is talk.
Yeah!
If you'd like to talk, call us toll-free right now at 1-866-472-5787. 1-866-472-5787.
That's it.
VoiceAmerica.com.
These days, everyone is looking for information on staying young, healthy, and fit. The Voice America Health and Wellness Network is here to help you on your quest to better health and a better you. We talk about everything from diet, fitness, and aging to substance abuse, personal growth, mental health, and much more. Learn from our experts who cover health and wellness from traditional and holistic perspectives. Tune in to the Voice America Health and Wellness Network. Healthy living starts here.
Listen for Trust Across America every week on the Voice America Variety Channel. Tune in as host Jordan Kimmel is joined by national experts in the fields of accounting, finance, organizational behavior, and sustainability, as well as companies that are applying strategies that are enabling them to be recognized as doing the right thing by the American Trust Awards. Your host, Jordan Kimmel, is himself a trusted professional with years of experience in applying strategies and consulting with today's leading firms. Trust Across America is heard Wednesdays at noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific, on Voice America Variety.
Each week, Jimmy Gould brings you the stories and the people that you want to hear about. Tune in to A Current Life to hear about the journey to success, how our guests became the people they are today, and the highs and lows they experienced along the way. Each hour will leave you inspired and entertained as Jimmy gets up close and personal with every week's guest and shares ideas you can identify with and apply to your own life. A Current Life with Jimmy Gould airs Fridays at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, noon Pacific Time on the Voice America Variety Channel.
Streaming live, the leader in Internet talk radio, VoiceAmerica.com.
You are tuned in to A Safe Place to Talk About Race with your host, Sharon E. Davis. We know you have something to say, so participate in today's discussion by calling 1-866-472-5788. That's 1-866-472-5788. Or send us an email to Sharon at safeplaceonrace.com. Now, back to the program.
Well, thanks for joining us again. We're talking with Dr. Philip Atiba Goff, who is the Assistant Professor of Social Psychology at the UCLA and also the Executive Director of Research for the Consortium for Police Leadership and Equity. Well, welcome back, Dr. Goff. We have a caller. Let's see if we can hear from Pam from Michigan. Hi, Pam.
Hi, Sharon. Thank you for this program once again. And to Dr. Goff, thank you for the research information that you're providing. You've got a difficult task. One of the questions I do have is in terms of the videotaping that is being used by law enforcement, has that shown to be of any benefit, and has it made a difference in the behavior of officers knowing that everything is being scrutinized now?
That's a great question, Pam. Thanks for throwing that out. There's kind of two answers to that. First, it may be useful to know that patrol officers frequently want the cameras, and they don't just want cameras on the cars, they want the body cameras. And that's because they want to protect themselves from getting lied on. So it's actually got strong support among chiefs and patrol officers. And I can say from working with San Jose, which has one of the largest patrol camera setups in the country, that it doesn't change the behavior of officers so much as it makes them confident when they know they've done something right or when they know they've done something wrong. But that's all anecdotally. The other thing we can't say is we can't say how much it changes the behavior of officers definitively, scientifically, because you'd need to record them without the cameras and then record them with the cameras. So I can't say in terms of a published study or anything that would pass scientific peer review that we know that. But what I can say is that you put officers on tape and they act like officers. I do a lot of research where we videotape their behaviors with civilians in both simulations and in the real world, and they just act like themselves. It's one of the things that makes it kind of endearing to work with them. I don't think they know how to be another kind of way, and there's a kind of honesty and integrity that you got to admire about that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Pam from Michigan. Well, along the lines of police officers and this unconscious mind, can you describe a little bit what you mean by the unconscious mind and race bias?
Sure. So, Sharon, let's play a little game. I think that when we met last time, I didn't get to do this with you. So if you'd indulge me, I think your listeners wouldn't mind.
Is this going to hurt?
Not going to hurt at all.
Okay.
I'm not going to embarrass you of Scout's honor. We're just going to play a little bitty game. Okay? Shout out the first word that comes to your mind. Okay? What kind of music did Peter, Paul, and Mary play?
Folk songs.
Folk. Okay, cool. What's the little wire in the middle of a bicycle wheel that holds it together?
Spoke.
Okay. And a comedian might tell this in order to make you laugh.
Joke.
Okay, great. And then what's the white part of an egg?
The white part of an egg.
Right. But you wanted to say yolk, didn't you?
I thought about it.
Yeah.
I did think about it.
And you had to think about it. And many of our listeners are like, oh, right, the white part is the white part. Now, when I do this live, I do a couple of more, so you outsmarted me. But the idea is that our brains put together, it's kind of like an office assistant, that puts together the things that we think are associated, because that's the stuff that usually occurs. If we think doctor, we're thinking hospital, right? We think mirror, we're thinking, you know, for women, we're thinking makeup. For guys, we're thinking shaving, right? These things go together.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes they go together so well that we make the mistake of saying them out loud, of substituting the things that we think go together. Now, when it comes to different identities, like gender, when we think male, now I got you thinking razor. When we're thinking women, I got you thinking makeup. When we're thinking black, sometimes we're thinking crime. And that happens regardless of whether or not you're a good, you know, unbigoted, you know, unbiased person. It's just there. It's in the ether. We pick it up, these associations. If you watch television, if you listen to the radio, not this program, but all the other ones, right? If you see, you know, video games, any other media, if you go online, these associations seep into your brain. And when they seep into your brain, they don't just come up when we're playing little games. They also come up when we're making important decisions, like the decision of, is this person dangerous? Are they armed? Is this person going to hurt me? It happens for officers. It also happens for residents and civilians. And that kind of short mental shortcut, it drives so much more of our behavior than we think. And it's so much harder to get rid of because you can't just think yourself out of it.
Well, in this regard, you've got me going here because, Dr. Goff, because, you know, if when I think of black, I don't think of crime. That's not the association that comes to mind for me. Is this association based on various cultural groups or what?
Right. So you would think, well, I mean, I've been black my whole life. I took a couple weeks off in college. But other than that, I've been black my whole life. And I associate good things with my people. Right? Mm-hmm. Why would I associate, you know, black with crime? And you do see differences. Some people have that association more than others. But the scary part of implicit bias is that you have that association more than you think.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't just decide, well, I don't think that's a good association to have, so I won't have it. You have it because you've been exposed to it. So I'm going to throw out the website of one of our collaborators, Project Implicit. If you just search for that, it's a website that's maintained on Harvard's server space. And Project Implicit, you can take what's called the Implicit Association Test. You know, just take the test, collect your score, trade them with your friends, and say, you know, I'm more racist than you and less racist than you. It's a fun little game to play, at least at the point where you're just testing it. There's lots of different IATs. But it's in our brains because it has to be, because we're paying attention to the culture. And when we don't have time to think, or we're otherwise overloaded with things, like at the end of a long day, or, you know, you're in the middle of a breakup, and you don't have time, have the emotional energy to be doing anything else, these implicit biases tend to come out more.
Well, I'm really glad that we're talking about this from a research perspective because we had an email from John from Detroit that referred to this a little bit,
mm-hmm.
and he was very, very strident. He says, why do they hunt black boys? The black officers see one and will do the same. If you treat them with respect, they give it back.
Yeah, and that, I have to say that's the first question that got us into doing this research in the first place. A community was essentially asking, do law enforcement trainers train patrol officers to kill black boys?
Yeah.
So when you have an incident like the Trayvon Martin tragedy, in which no law enforcement was involved in the killing of that child, it brings up more than a century of this kind of behavior by civilians and by law enforcement. I'll tell you this. I don't know any police trainer that trains folks to hunt black boys. But I'll also say, as a former black boy myself, I know what it feels like to feel like you're being hunted.
Mm-hmm.
And the hard part is, I think the writer wrote very, you know, directly, if you give respect, you'll get it back. It's not just about the amount of respect you give in that moment. Officers feel as if they, as a profession, have been disrespected for generations.
Mm-hmm.
And many in our communities feel as if we've been disrespected, hunted, occupied, not patrolled, for generations. And I gotta say, there's reasons on both sides of that argument. Law enforcement has a reputation for being racist, and they've earned that reputation. And as a result, you know, black and brown communities have a reputation for not respecting law enforcement, and we've earned that reputation. I'm not saying they're on par. They're not a moral equivalency. We have to hold law enforcement to a higher standard. But it's not simply the case that if you start giving respect, it's always returned. And in this case, in these situations, it can be life and death.
Exactly. Well, you know, this brings me to the point of a phrase that it's been in my head for years, and it's like we're in a war in slow motion at this transition point for the healing of racism. And I can't imagine what it would be like to be a youth, to be a police officer in situations and circumstances where instincts take over somehow, and the consequences of violence in our nation are just upon us. So I don't know that that we can do better in the past, but I know that we can do better for the future. And the questions that have come out in these emails and comments are very poignant. But it's like we are in a war in slow motion, Dr. Goff. When will this end?
I mean, if I knew, I'd have a crystal ball, my own TV show, and a lot more money than I got. But I will say this. If you think about this fantastic experiment of democracy, right, getting law enforcement right, getting equitable law enforcement, has got to be one of the last and most important pieces of it. And here's what I mean by that. When law enforcement's acting on behalf of one class of citizen against another class, it's protecting one of us from another one of us, as opposed to protecting all of us from harm, right? So by definition, when law enforcement is set up crooked, it's creating first and second class citizens. Now, we've done that with law enforcement on purpose for more of our country's history than we've done it right. But trying to do it, and law enforcement chiefs and sheriffs taking the initiative to go out and go above and beyond, they're not required to do it, that shows that we're moving in the right direction. It's painfully slow. It's deadly slow for some of us, but we are moving in the right direction. And understanding that this is part of the human condition, and it's a problem that's bigger than just, you know, a couple of officers work in Brooklyn, you know, and on NYPD, right, or a couple of folks that used to work Rampart in LAPD, understanding that this is part of the human experiment, so we've got to get it right this time, that gives me hope. I deal with some of the bleakest things that you see in the first world in terms of, you know, when we see poverty, when we see abuse, and when we see, you know, complete lack of trust in the state. That's about as bleak as it gets in the first world. And I wake up every day with hope that it's going to get better and that what we're doing today matters, because we have the power to do that change. And that's a unique component to democracy, small d, and something that I think should give us pause in terms of how badly we're framing it, and something that should give us a little bit of energy in terms of what kind of shift in the meter, right, shift in the needle we're going to be able to get done before we get taken off this earth.
Well, I tell you, what you've said is very important, because hope is what's going to see us through to these next levels. We'll be right back.
Talk, talk, talk. That's all we do is talk.
Yeah!
If you'd like to talk, call us toll-free right now at 1-866-472-5787. 1-866-472-5787.
That's it.
VoiceAmerica.com.
Ever wondered what private investigators really do and how they go about solving cases? Each week, PIs Declassified gives a glimpse into this little-known world. Join your host, Francie Kaler, a noted private investigator, in conversations with detectives and experts in the field. False confessions, forensic evidence, finding missing persons, exposing fraud, exonerating the innocent. All areas that Francie and her guests will cover. And have they got stories to tell? Tune in and call in to the live show Thursdays at 9 a.m. Pacific, noon Eastern, on Voice America Variety.
Step up to the microphone. View the finalists right now on VoiceAmericaKids.tv.
America's next great star is waiting to be discovered. Step Up to the Microphone is an exclusive presentation for VoiceAmerica.tv, where you can see and hear America's next top child star. The program is hosted by Voice America's own Cassie Frazier, and new episodes will be available every week exclusively at VoiceAmericaKids.tv. You can say you saw them at the beginning of their superstar career. Tune in to VoiceAmericaKids.tv.
Want the best life has to offer for you, your family, and friends? There are a number of community-based programs and resources available to individuals for low cost or no cost. No need surfing the net or spending hours on the phone. Now there's a radio program devoted to bringing you the information you need. Tune in to Outreach Today with hosts Melissa Jenkins-Simon and Diane Stafford and get the tools to success. Our program promotes the benefits and services of CI Incorporated, providing health and social services over a wide spectrum of resources and agencies. We want to help you. Tune in to Outreach Today, Wednesdays at 10 a.m. Pacific Time, 1 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Variety Channel.
The Internet's number one talk station.
Number one talk station.
VoiceAmerica.com.
You are tuned in to A Safe Place to Talk About Race with your host, Sharon E. Davis. We know you have something to say, so participate in today's discussion by calling 1-866-472-5788. That's 1-866-472-5788. Or send us an email to Sharon at safeplaceonrace.com. Now, back to the program.
Well, welcome back once again. We've been speaking with Dr. Philip Atiba Goff, who is assistant professor at UCLA and also executive director of research for the Consortium for Police Leadership in Equity. Well, Dr. Goff, you've been very insightful and enlightening, and we could go on more. But, you know, I would really like for our listeners to know a little bit more about you, the person. What drives you to do this work? Obviously, it's not only your interest, your career, you're very passionate about it, and you've done so many things that have been firsts, like the first link in psychological factor of an officer's past use of force, to the first empirical model for predicting police violence, and on and on and on. Why do you do this work, Dr. Goff?
So this is the biographical portion, I suppose. Where do I start? I was born at a very young age, and then a lot of not interesting stuff happened. Like I said, a lot of this is happy accident. The first thing that made me think about race as opposed to math, science, poetry, and music, which were the things that I loved to do before I got hit with this. I was a senior in high school. I had a bunch of friends. I was a normal high school student, and had an instructor who very subtly would just start to tear me down in front of my friends. Mm-hmm. And I had no sense of what that was about. I went to another teacher. It was a small private school where I went on scholarship. There was a black professor there. I went to him and I said, "You know, I don't know what's going on in this class, but it feels like something wrong." He said, "Finally, we've got a smart, you know, good straight A student who can take on this racist." I thought, there's no way. I don't live in the South, right? It's the 90s, which it was way back when. There's no way. But I started to learn that I didn't have the language to talk about what he was doing, because it didn't look like old-fashioned racism. And so in my own way, I got to thank him for developing in me. That was the hardest problem, and we're still developing that language. And so that accident piled on top of, you know, accidents in college and accidents in grad school and meeting Tracy Cassie. The last part of which that really stuck with me, I was writing an article for something else and wanted to take a look at, racial differences in police brutality, because we all know there's racial differences in police brutality. So I was just going to add that to the article, like there's racial differences in education and healthcare and the rest. And my mom's a reference librarian, at least she was for a long part of her career. I'm good at finding things. And 13 hours later, I hadn't found anything like definitive evidence of racial disparities in police brutality, because there were no statistics. There was no good research on so much of this. And so, just like, you know, many of the police officers I work with, I felt like this was something that needed doing, and there wasn't anybody else around doing it. And so when you get a chance to ask the question, not what do I want to do with my life, but what needs doing, you end up in really interesting places. That's how I've ended up here.
That's just remarkable, just remarkable. Well, you know, we have two more callers that are waiting. Let's go ahead and take caller Lynn from Michigan. Welcome to the show, Lynn.
Thank you.
And you have a question for Dr. Goff today, or a comment?
Well, you know, I just came in, but a question that I would have, what should people who have been, who have experienced racial problems with police or judges, is there a place to go? Is there, you know, where could you go get help?
Yeah, that's a great question. Now, with judges or with other parts of the criminal justice system, there are places to go and register complaints with the court. But with law enforcement, it seems counterintuitive. The place that you usually have to go is the police station.
Mm-hmm.
Because the police tend to investigate themselves. They tend to be charged with that. Now, many of us feel like, well, why would I bother? They're not gonna find anything. And what evidence do I really have that was about race? Here's what I would say to that. If you ended up okay, you ended up physically all right, then I would encourage you to go and do it, because if you don't make the complaint, they've got no sense of what's out there. The other thing I would say is that it is very tempting, and I found myself wanting to do this. I've had bad experiences with law enforcement for much of my life. Like I said, I've been black for a long time, and I used to have hair. And black men who got long hair, that's not a good combination sometimes. But you feel tempted to embellish the story because you don't feel like you're going to be believed. If you do that, you're going to be thrown out. So go to the police. Say, I'd like to talk to somebody about an incident where I felt like I had a problem. I'd like to talk to someone from Internal Affairs. They will take your complaint. They have to take it. They have to write it down, and they have to investigate it. If you don't embellish it, at the very least, it's on the record. And the next person that's got a problem with that same officer, they're more likely to be believed because you went there. So you may not get justice for yourself, but you provide the groundwork for other people to get justice. I wish there was a more satisfying answer, but right now, because we can't give somebody a racism test,
yeah,
we can't get videotape and say, ah, there, you can see in the videotape it's racist. Because we can't do that. It's so hard to prove. We all have to be committed to the next time, regardless of how badly this time went down. I wish there was a better answer than that, Lynn, but that's the best we've got so far.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Lynn from Michigan. Well, believe it or not, we only have 4 minutes left in the show, less than that. But let's see if we can get a quick question in from Clarence from Missouri. Hi, Clarence. Welcome to the show. Do you have a quick question?
Well, it's more of a statement, not a question.
Please,
because,
go right ahead.
First, you should understand what racism is. Look up the etymology, the legal description, the origin of racism. And when you talk about the police, they are verbally told certain things that's not written down, where they will not be held accountable for it. So people are singled out and looked at in a different perspective than other people are. So racism, if you want to talk about that, you need to know where it came from and what it's about to start with. And if you know the Constitution, you know the law, you know your birthrights, look these things up. Look your ancestry up. And therefore, you have a better way of looking at things, because the common law and the common sense that we, when we talk about black and white, we're talking about one thing. Politically, it means something else. So look up the Black's Law Dictionary. Look up the legal definition of these words, like person, like straw man. Why is your name in all caps? They use all these things against you, and you know nothing about them. So I suggest that you really start there and find out who you are. And then you can talk about a lot of other things in a more open-minded situation.
Thank you so much, Clarence. That's very insightful. Thank you for your comments.
You're welcome.
Well, Well, I tell you, Dr. Goff, this is a show that has to do with digging ourselves out of the ditch, and that's what we're doing by having you and others like you who are taking the time to give us the information and to talk with members of our human family about what we need to do. There is hope. It's just going to take a lot of work. Do you agree?
I do, but we got the right people in place in a lot of situations. It's a brighter story than sometimes any individual incident like the Trayvon Martin incident and the rest might lead us to believe.
Well, and now we only have 30 seconds left. I want to thank all of you who sent in emails and called into the show to get your information out there and to hear from Dr. Goff. This has been Dr. Philip Atiba Goff, and wish we had more time to go into that, especially your name, Atiba. Hope to talk with you next time.
Maybe next time. Thanks, Sharon.
Thanks for joining us. See you next week.
Thank you again for listening today. Please join host Sharon E. Davis for another edition of A Safe Place to Talk About Race next Monday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time, 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Variety Channel. We'll talk then.